I'm delighted to be here again today with Christian Baxter of the wonderful YouTube, Yours Truly. Christian, you've been talking to a lot of fascinating people lately.
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind. Something I've been just, I guess, choosing to keep doing.
I mean, I think that's great. One of the things that I've noticed about the whole YouTube world in the last 5 years is how, well, not just YouTube, but news and online and everything else, how it's moved from sound bites and short bits to these long form conversations where people actually are talking to each other and not at each other. And that's tremendously refreshing after all the years of confrontative argumentation on television between political pundits and talking heads. And so, I mean, this is just great when you can get a couple of people together who have ideas and they thresh them out and they actually listen to each other. It's golden.
Yeah, that's in this journey. I changed microphones. Is this too loud now or is it still
No, you
okay?
sound great.
Okay. This journey, that's been the emotional part of it for me. Let's see, 7, 8 years ago, well, really in the early 2010s, I feel like the discord and the dialogue that was being generated online that we were consuming was becoming more and more intense, more and more polemic. And also, even before that, a big part of my journey into the online space was watching, new atheist versus Christian debates in like when YouTube actually first started. That was some of the first early content that I was taking in that was available on there. It's like, oh, you can just get this, you didn't have to be there or buy a DVD. And by the nature of it being debate, that was, I was insecure about those ideas, I guess. So I was watching that with a lot of insecurity, but also there was, just a lot of ad hominem that would take place in discussions like that. And then as the conversation got more intense, online, when I would see something, well, really, that in this space that was represented by, say, like the intellectual dark web of, the glory days of of the beginnings of this conversation, really, when, for example, and again, like I say these names with a caveat because a lot of time has passed since that time, but when, say, Sam Harris sat down to talk to Ben Shapiro about free speech, it honestly was like a breath of fresh air to see these people that would have been talking so much more in every other situation, polemically and aggressively, kind of coming together to talk about being able to still just do this. And so when I would see those, that was always kind of emotional, like, oh, wow, there's like a space. And so, as a result of then certain things happened in my life. I did a lot of therapy and I actually did a lot of therapy online. And that also was informing about what you can do and what you can have, and even like this kind of conversation that we're having right now. So, that's kind of, I guess, the what's informed me kind of getting to starting to then pursue having those conversations myself, because I think this there was this intense creative process that took place of even just getting into playing in this space over the last 6 months. And I was just decided that I wasn't going to try to overthink a lot of things. And one of those things being, what should I call this thing? And a place to think out loud. And I think that that's like the tagline for the podcast. Welcome to Yours Truly, a place we go to think out loud. And that is because even though we, many of us, and you know this as well as anybody, you're consuming all this stuff, but you're not able to participate or have that conversation. Maybe you wish you could. And so providing a space for that as well, also knowing how beneficial it has been to be listened to. So that's a piece of it as well. So anyways, that's kind of from the hip on that topic.
Well, and for those that are new to Christian Baxter, I will point you to his YouTube channel. I'll put a link to that in the description. And I'll also put a link to, if you could give me a link to one of the best that actually tells your whole story so
Okay.
that people could get your backstory. And I'll put a link to the first conversation that you and I had,
Okay.
which was on your channel, so people can kind of catch up with your background. You sent me some really interesting topics for our conversation today, and they got me thinking, which I think is always a good thing. And the first one you said was maybe we could talk about something concerning finding better language for the telos of worship that can help bridge the meaning between theological distinctions. So could you say a little bit more about what put that question in your mind, and maybe a little bit more background about the question, and then we can start exploring it.
So one of the things early on getting into this space, like one of the first conversations I had with a fellow corner participant, a guy named Cale Zeldin, and he's Catholic. And it kind of represented a conversation that I've had a lot for a long time. Like my wife, like I was raised kind of low church, Baptist, charismatic. I married into a Lutheran Catholic family, very high church. So it was like this convergence of culture, this convergence of, distinctions of worship and theology, yet, all kind of still at this point in history considered within some idea of, small O Orthodoxy Christianity. And so that's always been made me curious, oh, well, what are you about? What are you about? What is this about? Why do you worship this way? And as a person that was a worship leader professionally for around 10, between 10 and 15 years, that was just always interesting to me because I knew what I was doing, this, long hair, rock and roll, hippie stuff that Jordan Peterson doesn't like very much. But and then but this more high historical sacramental worship, and just trying to understand that. And so, and as people can check out, Karen will link some of these videos where I'll go more into depth on my personal story, that having coming to a very low place, probably as low as I feel like I could get, that my faith kind of landed on, say, the solid rock, like, and that was like all that was left, as I kind of then reapproached being out of ministry, just attending church, with the conversations that I said, like, that I'd had over the course of years, and then evaluating things, evaluating the experience that I had of kind of hitting rock bottom. It and I'll I have to say this, and at that same time, that was whenever a lot of the ideas that Jordan Peterson was propagating into the culture, into this YouTube culture specifically, that was a big part of reconstructing meaning in my life, and it was informing how I was kind of viewing worship, not only as, so not as a leader anymore, but even now as a participant, but also as an observer. And so then coming into the space, I mentioned talking to Kale. I was just struck by how a lot of the people that I was having conversations with, or people that hang out with, like Paul Vanderclay online, you have people from all different stripes. Just they're talking about deeply meaningful things. They're talking about their faith, even their specific religion, whether that's Judaism or Orthodox Christianity or evangelicalism or Catholicism or these things. But it's not generally contentious or even pretentious. And so that's really, again, like refreshing. And so then I so okay, what is, you have like this spirit and you have these theological distinctions. But something that Jordan Peterson said early on, and that even was more kind of acutely teased apart recently on his conversation with Alex O'Connor, is what do you mean when you say, or you know, do you believe in God? Well, it depends on what you mean by believe. And he says, I want to live or act as if I do. And so that kind of got me thinking about corporate worship and these different ideas about, you know, what is sacred, what is really the telos of these different organizations, and not looking at it like what do they believe, but what by because of what they believe and then how they practice, what then ultimately in these different spaces are they oriented to, are they aimed at, what and going towards with worship. And you could say something like with you know, if you look at culturally the Christian music and the preaching in, within evangelicalism and how it is, well, how it's developed, you know, people can have opinions about the taste of thinking like having a rock band in church on a Sunday morning is appropriate or not. Besides that point, are these objectively good musicians? Have they been working on a craft of writing? And are some of them actually very excellent? The answer is yes. Now, if you go to a church and there's like five people that are mediocre musicians, and you're like, well, this contemporary worship isn't good. Well, it's that's a different thing. That's kind of it, as opposed to professional musicians. But because of how, if you take away, a theology of there being something real that happens within a gathered time of worship, not just things symbolize things and we get ideas, we are going to point our attention towards something and then treat it as if it is sacred. And by having, if we can understand that's what we're doing, we can say, oh, so this part of the church has made this sacred, where this part of the church has sacred practices around the Eucharistic, you know, communion. This church has sacred connection and practices around like music and preaching now. And they attend to them in that way, and they participate as if this is, you know, you could even say like the sacred cow. And I think that, I guess what I really am interested in is there become understanding, like coming to more of an understanding that saying, okay, what does it look like when you're attending to something kind of psychologically as sacred, versus what do this group say they believe about it? Not to abandon that, we have that, but I think that could create better understanding between people. I don't know if any of that made sense. It's still something that I'm trying to work out better, but it's something that I continue to kick around within conversation with people, especially people that are coming from all different stripes within, you know, the faith. So.
Yeah, I mean it the conundrum totally makes sense to me. And I've noticed the same thing talking to people from many different denominational traditions and backgrounds, and because it seems to me we all have one thing in common, and that is our love for God and our in most cases, what we have in common is our belief that Jesus Christ himself is God. When you say that we're putting our attention on the sacred or that which is sacred, I guess for me, the question arises, that's just never the way I think about it, the sacred. Because to me, I guess I have a very simple mind. God in Christ just is, and he's so real and he's alive. And so to separate that out as the sacred or something sacred, or even all the language around divinity, I think is creating a division. Now, obviously, there has to be a sense of my smallness and his bigness. So of course there is a gap, but he has reached down through that gap entirely to be with me as close as breathing. So in that sense, there is no division. But if I start attaching language that creates a division, it reminds me of when I lived in Japan. It was very troubling to read the Japanese Bible because Japanese language has four different sets of grammar and vocabulary based on the class to which you are talking. So if you're talking to a person who's lateral, there's a basic grammar and vocabulary for doing that. Then if you're talking to your boss, or if you're a child talking to your parent, or if you're talking to the pastor of the church, there's a level up. That's another whole grammar. If you're talking to your dog or your child, there's another whole level down. And then above all of that, there's a fourth level that was only ever used for talking to the emperor. They had a whole grammar and vocabulary for speaking to the emperor or speaking about the emperor. Well, when they translated the Bible into Japanese, they used that emperor language, which for the people reading, you know, like when we read, if you go back and read the old King James Bible, it says thou and thee and all of that, which we've been kind of trained to think that that's some sort of high language, but that was really more like the familiar, the tu in French. It's very familiar friend language. And so we have a sense of relationship with God, but in the Japanese Bible, it's this sense of far distant, so far beyond me that I could never get there. And I think there's a danger around this whole word sacred that is kind of the same thing, that is missing the relational aspect. Now, having said that, I also believe that we don't take God seriously enough in the evangelical church. I've been a part of the evangelical community for most of my Christian walk. And a few times I've gone to churches that were a little bit more high church, but mostly I've been in and around the evangelical church. And especially, I don't think we take worship seriously. And when I say worship, I don't just mean the 20 minutes where we're singing, but I mean the whole service of worship in church and outside of church. And I say this because I'm speaking to myself. I don't take this seriously enough all the time. And when I say serious, I also don't mean, oh, grumpy face.
Yeah.
You know, I mean with weight. And
right.
So one of the pastors that I like to listen to his teaching said something the other day. He was talking about, it's our responsibility to develop a character sufficient to bear the weight of our gifts. And he was speaking about, you know, maybe you have a gift of music, or you have a gift of mercy or, you know, that kind of gift. But I also think, what does it mean to develop a character sufficient to bear the weight of just the gift of salvation, the gift of Christ in us?
Yeah.
There is a weight of glory that if we get lost between our worth and our worthlessness, if we get lost in there someplace, then we're not recognizing that without him we cannot bear the weight of glory, but with him we can bear any weight. So I mean, I don't know. Maybe I've gone far afield here, but
so I guess, yeah. So a couple of things within something that has informed me. So again, I kind of talk about like this, my relationship within my family kind of coming together and like meeting at this place. And the context of it is that my mother-in-law, her brother he retired as an archbishop in the Catholic Church. She had two sisters that were nuns. One of them became Greek Orthodox later on. And she walked away from Catholicism because she looked around and thought within this structure and within this institution, it felt vacuous of a personal relationship with God. And so, yet she finds herself now in the later part of her life, longing for certain parts of that home within her, of how that culture attended to something that I would say is like sacred in their practice. So that's interesting, right? Because your point was this idea that God does something with individuals, personally and intimately. And so how it sometimes feels like, as a result, you get kind of this tension and also kind of these poles, right? Where something like like when your example with the Japanese Bible, if the whole thing is the Eucharist that only the priest can, and you're just here, which certain parts of, I think, medieval time, like people just sat and watched the priest do everything and left. Like they attended, but it wasn't. And so I think there was a disconnect in that regard. However, if it then is, say, you have 150 or 500 people that come into a space to worship, and it's you're only there just as an individual, receiving your, you know, beam from God, that then you're disconnected from something more corporate. And that is, it's actually, you know, it's very subjective. And it doesn't, there isn't anything other than try to figure out how to connect with God through this space that's offering you to do that. And so the Japanese Bible part, then again, with like this idea and this reality of like a personal connection to God. And so what has helped me, so I kind of talked about Jordan Peterson saying, well, it kind of, what do you, do you believe in transubstantiation? Like, I don't know if I believe in transubstantiation, but I want to worship as if I do. As in, I want to approach something. I want to, in my mind, attend to something that is like, if I participate as if there's a miracle taking place right now, that this is an actual, it's going to inform my practice and my participation. Kind of like, but if it's just this mindless thing that we're going, that many of us do many times, just go because this is what we're doing. And that there are things, there's ways that we can orient ourselves to that. The other piece of it is something that Jonathan Bugeaud has helped me as another kind of simple reference point of, and I know here you cover it a lot, all the way down to the molecular and cellular of the fractal reality of things scaling up and down. And I would, so that's something that I think about with worship is like this, well, the fractal reality of attending to things as sacred, it's going to look a little different. And to say something like the communion meal, If you sit down at work by yourself and you say a prayer before you eat your lunch, that's a simple act of you and God as an individual. And then you go home at dinner that night. And again, the way our world is, like these things, can't take for granted that this is normal for everyone, which this is kind of to my point about like levels of sacredness. Like the family dinner meal around the table, and there being some form of a liturgy to that, simple as it may be, that the oldest sets the table, the youngest pours the drinks, the mother prepares the meal and the dad sits down and comes in and he blesses the meal and they commune together, they talk together. And that's like scaling up like this idea of a communion around a sacred practice, which is sustenance. But then saying let's make this point to where that communion meal corporately with the church and you as a person, that we're attending to something more sacred, and not just, but even the fact that we're gathering this once a week is for this around this idea, but also around this reality of where heaven meets earth. And that framing these things, I guess part of what I'm saying is you in the encouragement also, because oh well, in this space, if you talk to a lot of people that are getting excited about participating with Orthodoxy, then it's like, oh well, then I just have to go be Orthodox. And part of me is thinking like, you can attend to things more like that, if you're still wanting to be in the priesthood of all believers, you can help you attend yourself towards that kind of pattern and that kind of fractal nature and how you scale in and scale in and scale in and approach worship. And like you kind of had mentioned that you don't, it's, I think you said something like you don't feel like you approach worship as sacred enough. And, you and I probably both come from this, come as you are, and we want to do life together, and it doesn't matter if you're wearing this or that, and all those types of things, which was, a cultural reaction to something that seemed very not personal. And so
Which,
there is a tint.
excuse me, has gone like way too far, like so way too far that it's not even funny. Like, I kid you not, during, you probably know this, during COVID, when we were doing church at home because the church was closed down, there were a few churches that stayed open and paid a heavy, heavy price for it. But we went along with our church closing down, and we went along with doing church on Zoom, and when it would come time for communion, they would say, if you don't have juice and if you don't have bread, just get some orange juice, a cracker, just whatever. I'm like, no, something is seriously wrong here. Well, first of all, if I go back many years in my Christian walk, in any church that I went to, there was always a very serious time before taking communion where the pastor would read the entire passage relative to the communion and talk about the meaning of it and how important it was that your heart be right with the Lord before you participated in this. And if you weren't a part of this, if you didn't have a faith in this, then it was a very dangerous thing to participate in this unworthily. And just reading the scriptures made that really clear. They don't do that anymore in my church. They just, let's gather around the table as if everybody's supposed to know. It's open to anybody. And, are we putting people in danger because we're not speaking to them about what the truth of God's word says? This is what I mean about not taking things seriously, because word is true. It's truer than true, as Jordan Peterson would say. And that means that when consequences are discussed, that they're somehow very, very true. So yeah, when I say I don't understand the meaning of the word sacred, what you have just gone through tells me a little bit more about what you mean when you say sacred. So
well, I have an example that I've shared.
You're talking about the whole idea of something that is set apart as holy. Is that?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the word, I could be wrong with my Latin or Greek, whatever it is, consecrated would mean with sacredness, you know, and made sacred. And that has to do with how we attend to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even no matter what setting that you're coming from, and acting like consciously making the choice that I'm going to pursue this in a different way. Now, that may mean that you have to change where you go, but I think that the idea of, well, here's my two examples. One was recently, I saw a tweet or something, and it was from Saddleback Church, and it said, I don't know if this was real, but it was like, hey, our Metaverse Saddleback worship service is awesome. And it was like, so this like computer camera, you know, it was like going through this digital cathedral building, and there are all these weird looking little avatars that look like video games. Yet at the front of the kind of sanctuary, there was a screen that was like streaming in the music from Saddleback. And there were just all these kind of odd little avatars. And I was thinking, oh, well, of course, if you don't have a line by which you say something is real, and even with your example about like Zoom communion, which is the other part of it, well, that's, is what can you not do in a digital space? You can't eat, drink, or smell, or touch. And I think that that makes that even more sacred, because that's something that, but if it doesn't have any real meaning and nothing is actually happening, but it's only a symbol, then you could hold up a digital wafer and a digital juice inside. And then that's just, is the representation. So I think that's one aspect of it. The other one is trying to get to this idea of like, how do we define or describe something as sacred? And I think the way I've in this space that I've tried to think about it is, you know, having situations where, say, you're leading worship and a microphone stand falls over, or even like something like the drum cymbal falls over. Even in the most kind of worshipful setting, if something like that happened, it would be awkward, but it wouldn't be a gasp. Whereas if you were at a service and, say, something like a priest drops the chalice, like that, what that would evoke is like a violation of something sacred taking place within a religious practice. But on the other hand, if those things would have happened, that would be awkward. Or somebody, you know, because there's not, I would venture to say that I was talking to Neil deGrade this past week, and we were talking about like why in certain places you look at when you would say something like, oh, you made an idol out of football, or you make an idol out of this rock band, or you make an idol, and so let's make, because we need to make church something more than that, our worship and our participation something more than that. But I feel like culturally we've come to a place where we're just trying to compete with the entertainment, and something about our worship doesn't transcend the level of entertainment as sacred practice and participation. And I do think that line that you mentioned about, like, you do risk moving into that space, like a removal of something possibly personal. But I think that those are some of the big picture culturally what we're experiencing, and why I think it is. I think it's part of the meaning crisis, because in a certain sense, if you're just giving up, quote unquote, a TED talk and a concert as for worship, it's because it has moved into this space where it just is a part of the entertainment landscape within your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's another piece of what I'm pointing at as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One thing I'd kind of like to throw in there is that when I was thinking about worship this morning, I was thinking worship is really about remembering. It's really about, one way to look at it is we get together on a Sunday morning so that we can remember what it is that we're all about and who it is that God is, and that he is good and that he is trustworthy and that we can trust ourselves into his hands. I've been reading through Chronicles again lately, and when you get to the end of Second Chronicles and just king after king after king, God is on their side and they're worshiping and serving God and everything is going great. And then when everything ends up going great for them, then they turn away or they begin to worship foreign gods for no reason whatsoever. And it has to be because they forgot. They had a momentary forgetting that God is good and God is trustworthy. And when you lean on the world cannot bear the weight. The world cannot bear our weight. We are creations of a holy God. And so we are in some way reflections of his glory. And his glory is the most massive weight in all the universe. And the world cannot bear the weight. So in that sense, worship is about remembering. And what that says to me is that we should want that to be a part of every moment of every day. That when we come together on Sunday as the body, we are coming together to remember the body and the importance of the body. And that should also be something that we carry with us every day, serving and loving one another and be being responsible members of the body. And you know, in the actual human body, everything is doing its part all the time, unless some cancer cell decides to go off and do its own thing,
right.
You know, which is then, you know, a huge detriment to the body. But I was thinking about just a little thing this morning, like the last 4 years, my husband's been working at home because during COVID, he started working at home and then his company decided to get rid of their office space because why not, you know?
Right.
So he works at home, and over those 4 years, I've kind of gone from a place of resenting not having my own space anymore, ever, you know, to now kind of rejoicing in the fact that not only is he here, and I'm not trying to put myself up as some kind of, you know, model of anything because I'm a total screw up, but in this one sense, I have learned something valuable. And that is that if I notice that he's got a cup of coffee brewing on the coffee maker, I can wait for it to finish and I can give it that last 30 seconds in the microwave and take it in and give it to him so he doesn't have to come in and get it. Or if I see that he had a scone in the toaster oven, I can put it on a little plate and carry it into him. And I can do that with rejoicing and without resentment. And it's a little opportunity to worship God. It's a little opportunity to say, I'm thankful that I have somebody to serve. I could be resentful that somebody needs serving, but I have a husband and I have somebody who loves me and I have somebody who, you know, has provided a home for me and I have a microwave and I have a coffee maker. And these are reasons. And so I try to train myself to be thankful, to recognize God's goodness in everything so that Sunday is another day to worship, but it's not the only day to worship. That worship is something that wants to be the pattern of our lives. It wants to be the pattern of our lives, scaling all the way up and down.
And so the two things that I would think on that is one being, you said something like, what was it not being able to bear the weight of?
The world can't bear the weight.
Yes. And I think that something like trying to have, there's certain things that can't, I don't feel like, which is, you know, not that I have a strong argument for, but doesn't feel like, there are certain things that don't feel like they can hold the weight of glory, you know, hold the weight of the holiness of the transcendent, of the divine. When I think we want to be awed, or we want to be put into such a place that allows us to attend to something that is more greater, holy, higher. And I do think that is like what you're expressing is the actual beautiful part of the spirit that is embodied within, you know, kind of the evangelical part of Christianity, is this realization that we as people, as individuals, are connected to God in a serious way. And but I sometimes feel like that like hits a ceiling of in the spaces that we have, to that isn't enough to hold, like going up something within the ability to participate in religious practice. And that is something that that like participating in something like the church calendar more and more has shown me is this idea that if kind of like, and take this with a grain of salt, if every day is quote unquote worship, then like no day is worship in a way, because it like flattens out the meaning so much that it, but if every day is Sunday, then what is Sunday? And so like, there's like some kind of distinction there. And that, you know, I, growing up, I would hear this kind of sermon a lot, or it was passed along in some kind of early viral videos about, well, okay, this is an example. You know, it's Friday, but Sunday's a coming. I don't know if you ever heard that kind of, it's a Friday, but Sunday's a coming.
That was in reference to the resurrection, right?
Yes, 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 it is. And however, it was almost like, yeah, that suffering stuff, you know, don't, let's not, and instead of being able to take like a day. Oh,
let's not dwell on the cross, yeah.
Instead of being able to take a day and set that day apart to focus on this aspect of our faith that in so many ways is actually how we can relate, how we understand that a God can relate to suffering, is actually like an important way that we can, that when you set something aside and you say, we're going to take this part of this story and we're going to actually kind of consecrate it to have serious value and meaning in how we can participate in our faith, when we do that, it changes how you're approaching this. It's like, instead of I don't know, there's something to just that I think about when it comes to approaching and attending to where we put the what is our aim here? If it is only the personal for and it but it, or if it's only at the top, like doesn't matter what the personal life's doing as long as I go and get this thing, but rather that these things converge and these things converge at a high point. And that's like a pattern for like the week, I guess. I don't know.
Well,
I
I
that's
know
just
I yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was missing that when I was talking about that, the idea that if every day is the same, then we lose the hierarchical structure really of our days. There is a rhythm to the days, and we see that even in Genesis 1, you know, that there's a rhythm, there's a stacking, there's something that comes first, and then there's this culmination, and there is the day of rest. And again, I do think that that the whole idea of the day of rest is the idea of not just rest, not just doing nothing, but an idea of restoration and of being filled again and of remembering again. So this whole time has gone by, and then we come to this place of remembering. And this is, I mean, one of the things that I hear people often say is, and I've said it myself, is I wish there was more liturgy in the church. In the evangelical church, meaning I wish that they had more corporate times of corporate prayer, they had more times of reading the scripture. I think that we're really missing out on that. I wish that we were standing when the scripture was read. You know, there's a whole lot of things I wish, but is that when we just give it a word liturgy, are we losing something by just hanging a word on that? Or are there just certain elements that need to be there in order for the remembering to take place in the most powerful way, transformative way that we are not only informed but transformed through the times of worship that we spend together?
yes, the so the work of the people, the liturgical work of the people, I think that's the one of the translations of that word. The idea that you come like I'm coming to get my cup filled or something like that. I don't know if you've that language is familiar to you, but that's kind of about like just the act of consuming. Of only consuming as opposed to this idea of participation. Of course, you're invited to sing, you're invited, but there's no kind of impetus that's necessarily required or necessary. Where I would say something like, Verveke's ecology of practices and procedural knowing, that those types of things are what I would say you're pointing at with why would we, and even this idea, so if this word is important and if we stand when the bride is coming down, why are we doing this thing? Or, historically when a lady comes in a room because, to show this honor, that isn't just, okay, yeah, I believe that this word is holy. I believe that this word is true. I believe that it gives wisdom. What is, but just the belief of those things without embodied practice is something I've just called like I'm just mentally assenting to all this thing. And so that becomes the, as long as they're doing and saying everything right that I believe, then it's fine. And I don't even have to even do anything because it's all matched to my mental assent of what my faith is. Where the participation and like John's word, and my understanding of his language is pretty elementary, but this idea of having an ecology of practice, if that something like historical liturgy where you read and you respond, and it's a relational religio type thing that's happening, but it also is formative, and I think a deep way that I'll give one example. I think it, growing up, you know, I had an experience where I understood something about me, you know, 15 years old, me being a sinner, God being, you know, holy, me needing forgiveness to have this right relationship. But I think, but I still was very, like my idea, my category, my language for the gospel was still pretty anemic. Like it still was very vague. And, you know, I think that if I had asked my wife if she could tell me what the gospel was, because of like this formative participation of liturgical practice in her life, with the same thing like saying the Nicene Creed, you know, a couple hundred times in her life, that gave like a more clear category to be able to kind of like understand these things. And that was through this meaningless rote religion, right? There's no meaning, because if you don't believe it in your heart, then it has, then it doesn't mean anything. And, but I think I believed something in my heart, but I had trouble like knowing how to even understand it, because I didn't have something rote to hang it on, to frame it with. And so things like, having that you can have through participation, where you're not just like consuming an experience or an event only, but that you have that kind of participation. And of course, this happens by choice for an individual. If they want to know what every song is going to be every Sunday, and they talk to the worship leader and they figure it out, and then they're like, I want to be ready, I want to participate in this fully, you know, versus being able, because say the liturgy is either written there for you, or because you have a lot of it memorized, that you get into this space. Now, again, there's critiques on, does that mean anything if you're just doing it memorized, whatever. But I think that like that's one part of it, is that there is a procedural knowing that you get that can go into very deep places that we can't even really describe. And when I was talking like about my mother-in-law longing for the home of Catholicism, but still not knowing, like not feeling like she wants necessarily to go be Catholic, but looking for places to participate that way, because I think there's a knowing, like a procedural knowing related to her history that carries actual meaning for her spiritually. That so, and that goes back to some of the stuff about the being able, the weight of that meaning within our lives. And to your point, even talking about earlier in your life, when even say something like the Baptist, or I don't know what kind of church you were involved in, but they go through and they even fenced the table. They made it exclusive. They made it set apart more by saying this is important. And that practice created a deeper sense of meaning for the participation in that. And then you also, then you went all the way to the Zoom communion, which, yeah, that's where the interesting part about what you believe about that, participating in that, really comes into play. And within the space moving forward, what's going to keep people from just being like, well, I can do metaverse church online, because there's nothing calling me. Because if everything is only symbol, if everything only has meaning in the ideas, then I can get those ideas in my digital metaverse church. And so I think that how we are in the future choosing to attend to and participate and treat our gathered times, that it isn't, we're having to move through part of this, is that it is only about, not only, but that we participate in it in such a way that it's not only about the ideas, but about how we actually do this thing, the doing of it. And we've been scared to do that because of works and everything.
Well, but I mean, if you go back 100 years, if you go back even 50 years, for me, I can only go back as a Christian. I became a Christian when I was 32. So I've been a believer for 43 years. Okay. So I'll go back 43 years. even then, there were a lot of Protestant churches that had liturgy. They had specific prayers that they did. We did the Nicene Creed at the beginning. We would stand and we would sit. We would stand and we would sit. There would be the singing, primarily the singing of hymns, some worship choruses. So over time, that's just been cast away, along with the pastor wearing a suit and all those other things, has been cast away in this idea of we have to be modern. And I've noticed, especially in the last 20 years, that the maybe 30 years, the generations have now been separated, because if there are people that want to stay with the more traditional music, they have an 8:30 service and everybody else has a 10 o'clock service for the contemporary. And then not only that, but now we've separated church from church, because the contemporary worship service, every church wants to be something, doing something new all the time. So you have this rock band up there, and every Sunday it's three or four new songs that you've never heard before. So you can't sing along. You can't participate, because you can't get into the song and let it get into you, and it doesn't walk away with you at the end of the service and remain in your heart and speak to you all week long, the way that even back when in the beginning days of Hillsong, go back 30 years, let's say, the beginning days of Hillsong,
Shout to the Lord. Shout to the Lord, Darlene Sheck in the 90s.
But that was something that practically every church you went to knew that song, that they were all doing. But it's not that way anymore. Now every church has a different group that they follow, or they do their own music. A lot of them do their own music. Okay, great. We've got music everywhere. It's like all these YouTube channels, right? And it's like they're no, there's all everybody has this individual silo, and every church has their individual silo, and nobody's participating anymore with the larger body. I think
Or
it's a
it,
disaster.
like, yeah, I that
Disaster.
that that's part of what I'm pointing at. And I think so. This idea, part of it is that we, you mentioned Hillsong specifically, and I think, and it is about at the 20-year mark. 2003, I was a senior in high school, and that's I was starting to lead worship for our church. And it's kind of like this thing where at that time, there were like four organizations, maybe, that were kind of putting out studio quality songs, and that, and say it was Hillsong, and then the early Passion stuff and Vineyard, and that there wasn't a lot of other that were actually producing that stuff. And something you said, like, well, if every church is singing the new song Shout to the Lord, or the new song Chris Tomlin's How Great Is Our God, there's still, but if you have, now you have 1,000 different bands, or even if you say there's something like 10 churches that have been putting out this music, but it's like, and they put out an album every year. What we've done in that space is we've put the artist as the priest that's administering this the sacrament, but what does the artist want? New inspiration constantly. And so then it creates this churn, and it's like you have the band. So like as a worship leader, by the time I got a song to a new song to the church on a Sunday morning, I'd already been exposed to that song 15 or 20 times, playing it. So I already had 15 or 20 Sundays worth of that song. And okay, gosh, now I'm tired of it. And so I'm not gonna play that again. But the church has just sang it once or twice. And we feel like we have to keep up with the next thing that's coming. And as a result, so there isn't, and there's not a theology for it really to combat that churn. So I've told this story before. When I was about 16, and I had started like doing some youth group worship songs at my First Baptist Church where I'm from, and they were like, "Hey, let's have you guys do some of the songs, the songs for Sunday evening worship service." Okay, great. We're excited. This stuff is meaningful to us, and we want to share this with the church. And I get up there, and there's the 60-something-year-old deacon as I start playing the song, his face just gets redder and redder and more red and more red. And finally, he just storms out angry. Here I am singing some, like Third Day song in 2002. And I was just like, oh man. But what, the way I look at it, to kind of the point that you just unpacked, is that I was in a certain way. We can talk about taste and about what's important. Well, can you not see that there's five kids up here on the stage that are excited about the same Christ that we say that we confess? The problem is that we were destroying his meaning in worship. And that kind of like we weren't just doing something else. We were just like that ecology of practice and that all those things of what it means to go and to go to church. Like we were completely destroying that for him. And I think that's one of the reasons why that part of the change at the church was so contentious within the low church during that time, specifically Baptist evangelicalism, is because so much of the meaning was the music was holding so much of the meaning for worship by itself. And so if I changed the music, then I changed the whole meaning of the whole project, the religious practice. And these hymns that they had sung and for their whole life, 40, 50, 60 years, and you're like, and then the prophilicity from that point on, it's just like it's gone. Like, and so part of this other conversation about liturgy, about that kind of participation, and also the what kind of meaning can be held in raising your view of communion, no matter where you're at in church, is allowing other things to carry the weight of meaning that I think it should appropriately be spread out from, but also be more concentrated on something else that, that is even more set apart. It's interesting what you said about the Zoom worship, where it's like, well, if you don't have grape juice or wine, it's fine. If it's orange juice or, piece of bread or something, and you're like, why can't we say, even though I don't theologically have the point that this is more than a symbol, we're gonna choose to make this to say it's not okay if we do that, and that's because we. What's really more important? I don't know. That's the telos of evangelicalism is the message, the good news is more important than the practice. So as long as we're talking about the good news, that's and I think that
Well,
that's
yeah,
difficult.
except words mean something.
Yes, they
Okay.
do.
And in the communion, even set aside consubstantiation and transubstantiation and all of that, just set that aside. The words say bread and wine. I think there are good symbolic reasons for that, or I mean, it's filled with deep symbolic meaning there. Not the least of which is that bread is made from grain. It not only goes through this whole process of growing and being harvested, but then is trampled underfoot and crushed and goes through a process of suffering to be made into flour, to be made into bread. That whole process is deeply meaningful. And grapes are the same way. Grapes come about in a way and then go through this crushing process and suffering process and fermentation process. And that all has some sort of meaning. But orange juice and crackers don't have that meaning. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and so what, how we choose to attend to those things, either from leadership and as individuals, changes the way that we approach our worship. But some of these things sometimes get taken for granted. And I think that even with the stuff we were talking about with the modern worship movement is certain things being taken for granted. Oh, because this is meaningful right now to me as a 18 or 16 or 20-year-old, will it be meaningful to me 20 years from now, 30 years from now? And will this song continue to be meaningful to me 30 years from now? And maybe yes, there are songs that could be like that. But I feel like that music isn't doesn't it can't hold it holds a lot of meaning and a lot of power, but it can't hold all of it. And I and to the same and to the same point, I think that with preaching it, that if that even though words are powerful and ultimately very important, that again it is the whole, to use John's words, like the ecology of the whole, not just the one in particular, but then within that, how we order and structure it can help us come to and attend to a more like sacred order to this thing. And so anyways, that I guess I'm just hoping that there can be language to help within this crisis that we kind of find ourselves in, because I think you pointed to that crisis within this churn of new music. That's actually kind of like a worship crisis. And I think that we need help in these spaces. And it's not always the best thing to just be like, well, you need to pack up and go to the X, high church down the road. But even within certain parts of the Christian faith that aren't that helping them find ways to attend to and to elevate the parts of the confessions that they already have that exist into raising to things that are important that can't all just be held in a really, really good rock ensemble. Even though I like a really, really good rock band.
Well, I think you point out one of the things that is a strength of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. And a great weakness in the Protestant Church, and that is that if you're in a Catholic parish, that's your parish, that's your neighborhood, that's where you live, and that's where you go. And if you get unhappy with it, pretty much your choice is to either stay there and work through whatever your issues are, or to leave, and then you're not in the church anymore. I mean, you can't like go church. You really, I mean, I might have it wrong, but at least in the old days, you didn't go church shopping in the Catholic Church. That was your parish. And the strength of that is that those are your people. That's your community. You're not responsible for the whole world, but you are responsible to care for the children that are baptized in that church and to pray for the parents of those children and to participate in the life of that body. And I'm pretty confident it's the same way in the Orthodox Church. In the Protestant Church, the way it's become in the last 30 years is with the proliferation of all the different churches and many of the churches are just some guy that's got an idea. I mean, in our area, there's some guy that came here from Australia 11, 12 years ago or something like that. God told him to start a church. Now, I'm not going to question his vision. He started a church and it's grown to be a very big, very powerful church. And every year he talks to God and God tells him where else to put a church. And so he's put churches in Rome and he's put churches in other states in the United States and other countries. And he's got this thing going on. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea. But churches are proliferating everywhere like this. Now, maybe that's a good thing, or maybe it makes too many options for people. And it's this combinatorial explosion of all these possibilities. So if I get unhappy with whatever is not liturgical enough in my church, or maybe the pastor is annoying or something, I can hop over here to this other church and go in and participate there until I get unhappy. And So the anytime you do that, you don't have to deal with yourself and your own issues anymore. You don't have to deal with the people that are complicated in this group body of people. You can just go someplace else. And that's a disaster. It's a disaster for the body of Christ, I think. And I have participated in this myself, going from church to church, because I can't, maybe I can't deal with the way they're doing the worship music. It's just driving me crazy, you know? So I go
I
someplace
think.
where I can deal with the worship music. Okay, so does that mean then that I am not really, if I were in a Catholic church, I would have to be more faithful, you know? I mean, so I understand why people are struggling with all these issues.
Yeah. Oh, that is this, this idea that the new idea is going well. There's a couple of pieces there. One of them, again, is this: what if the telos is to reach, then that is going to be what the goals are. That is going to is so go out and build, reach, go keep proliferating. However, that might not necessarily take into account that, like, that's part of what I'm trying to, that's kind of part of what I'm trying to do is not like go out and start new things, but like attend to where you're at and try to allow that place where you're at to be elevated, to a more healthy real place of religious practice. And that is more than just good sermon and good music, even though I don't know exactly what you mean when you say the worship music's annoying. If it, I think that is a problem, that rock music has an objectiveness to it. Like, is it in time? Is it in tune? Is the person singing, if it's just going to be this one voice, is the one voice of a certain quality? Are they making a cohesive pattern of music? And so that also creates a another issue of, like, if worship is in only if it's about the heart and it's only mainly encapsulated through music, you're going to come up with some issues there as well, because well, as long as their heart's in it, then it doesn't matter. And there's a weird nihilism about musical quality that then comes into play with that. But that idea of, I mean, this more ordered existence, this more ordered reality of like a parish life, is also wrapped up in the scale of these mega cities. Like, I think you're close to one, and that it's hard to, well, it's hard to orient your life that in that certain way. I think about in my small town, where on Main Street you have First Baptist, First Methodist, the Episcopal Church, and the Presbyterian Church around the corner. It's like in this locus of area, physical space. And even as a kid going to like the First Baptist Church, like when church let out and you have like these three other churches, and there's this, you kind of see this whole thing happening there at that time. Yeah, I know, but they sprinkle their babies over there, and they don't drink over there. But like, okay. And now, like, well, we got churches on the edge of town, in a big box that's putting on a great show, but like there's not like this concentric thing happening. And so I do think that there's something to the idea of kind of that parish life. And again, not even, well, it's funny because then if you go, like, there's these two other areas in town where if you go down to the west part of town, there's West Baptist and the other Methodist church, and then there was a Church of Christ church, and they're all like in this little locus. And if you go start going east, there's Nazarene Church and another Church of Christ church. Like, you kind of see, like, they're what the, you can kind of see that what we're talking about, that there was still this idea about that. But if you say that that doesn't matter, the only thing that matters is the message and the way that you're presenting it, then you can do that anywhere. And so that does create then a profilicity that probably is driven more by market force. And so, yeah, I get that's, there are multiple layers to this conversation. And I think it plays very, very much into the meaning crisis and where we find many millennials like myself that have deconstructed and don't know, like, and you're trying, because there's this, like, the order of reality is not very clear anymore.
Well, let me tell you about the little church where I became a Christian. I lived in Iowa at the time, and I lived in a small town, and there was a little country church that was equidistant from five small towns. So it was out in the country. And the pastor had been a missionary to the Navajos for 25 years before he came to pastor that church. He was a guy from Kansas. And he was just such a real person, you know, he was a real person. And he always would say that it wasn't about building the perfect message. It was about what God did in the man that created the message. And so every week he would come with a new message, and was always somehow connected to what God had been doing in him during the week as to how he would interpret the scripture according to the transformation that was taking place in him, or maybe not taking place, as the case may be, you know, when he needed to be repentant before us. And but every week when he would preach, I would feel like God was talking directly to me, and everybody in the church felt like God was talking directly to them, because whatever it was that was being taught in that message was drive home. But in this church, there were people of all ages, and we'd have Sunday morning church together. There'd be an adult Sunday school before church, so all the adults would go to Sunday school classes, and the kids would go to the children's classes. The Sunday school classes were on different topics. So we weren't separated out by age. We were separated out by topics. People of all ages were everywhere. And then on Sunday evenings, we'd all get together, and there'd be classes for the kids, and the adults would go into the auditorium, and there would be a time of pop-up testimonies. This is what God's been doing in my life this week. Different people would stand up and, you know, read a scripture, or this is what God taught me, or this is the miracle that happened in my life, or here's where I'm struggling, I need prayer. Then we would have a time of hymn singing together. You could request any hymn you wanted, because there were these ladies that could play gospel piano like you just couldn't even imagine. And we would all sing together, and then the pastor would talk for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'd all go into fellowship hall, and all the ages would be together, little kids all the way up to the old people. And we'd all gather around and talk with each other and have family together. And people would just bring whatever finger food was left over from the rest of the day. And then after the small meal that we'd all have together, different ladies from the church would be responsible for different Sundays. And we'd go in the kitchen and we'd all clean up together. And we all knew each other, and we all built our families together. And it was amazing. And then we had Wednesday night where we'd come together for Bible study, and everybody'd be in their different Bible studies, but again, it would be all ages. That's been lost, or maybe it never was any place except that place. But that place felt like heaven to me. And I think one of the things that's happened now is that the churches hire out all this stuff. Somebody else is doing the cleaning up. Somebody else is cleaning the bathrooms, you know. Everything is a paid task. There's a person who's a Sunday school person, and the person who's the children's pastor. You have all these paid tasks where in that little church, we had the pastor. He was the only guy that got paid. Everybody else did everything. And that made for community. It made for participation. And we loved
yes.
being together, right? And we loved learning together.
Yep.
And we loved being spoken to by God together on Sunday morning. And
I'm pretty convinced right now that we should take the Dunbar number seriously in church. That scaling a church to, like you said, if you get to the point where you can hire out all these tasks and there's no responsibility other than to come and consume the excellent, funny this and the excellent, amazing, transcendent music that, that doesn't, you're not a community. You're just coming, consuming a live concert and a live, you know, bit to a degree, like, and where the investment of that pastor that you had, like, in a way, he was, to me, that sounds like he was operating in a more priestly role. Like, he was giving this place to this amount of people spiritual care, and he was, it sounds like, doing a good job of it. And there was this parish life that you were kind of pointing to. And that's, I think that that can only be done by two, like, with 150 people. And then it's like, well, if you want to have 150 kids, if you want to have
238 on a good Sunday, maybe. So,
okay. So, yeah, but that, you know, but you're going to kind of hit that ceiling of what he can, who he can really care for well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's what, like, 100. That's 120 so adults or something. And I, instead of seeing that as a barrier that we have to break, which has been kind of the church growth model. Like, if you read the literature on church growth, it's pretty interesting. I enjoyed reading it when I was trying to grow a church, you know, but, like, is it's kind of like, that's cute and that's quaint, but you want to bust through that. And to do that, you have to hire more people so that they can then create their own Dunbar over here within the church. And so then, so for, you know, to get to 500 people, you need like three people that can, like, you know, do the children, do the youth, and do the adults. And I think that we don't take it serious that, as I think there is, that's like a pretty hard and fast capacity of some kind of anthropological, sociological reality that we are denying. Kind of like when we deny hierarchy, it becomes implicit in a Paul Vanderclay gave me this example of, like, well, who's really the authority if you have a group of pastors when one walks in the room? Oh, we're all the same. We're all a priesthood of Lear. It's the guy with the biggest church and the book deal. Everyone's looking at him, you know, whatever, because it's an implied hierarchy that just takes place. Instead of, instead of it being an explicit hierarchy where you have, like, well, there's the bishop. It doesn't matter if he sold a book, he's the bishop. And that's an explicit hierarchy. Well, instead of, like, this implicit growth, these implicit growth barriers that you had to break through and making them explicit growth markers of what you are going to actually be able to do well, like, almost as a law of what you can do. And but with 150 people in a place, you're not going to have the greatest rock show on a Sunday, and you're not going to be able to hire the most qualified.
Thank you. The thing I forgot to tell you about was, we had these two ladies that played piano. They would alternate Sundays. But then we had every kid in the church who could play an instrument. They would get together on Sunday evenings and practice. They would practice for the following Sunday, and they would do at least a couple numbers.
Yeah. You know,
there'd be a clarinet player and a saxophone player, and a trumpet player, and somebody who would play drums, and they would do their best.
Yeah.
It wasn't very good.
Yeah.
It was terrific. It was a time of rejoicing. There's these little kids up there playing with all their hearts. It doesn't matter whether it's a rock band and you've got light and smoke and all that stuff. These were kids that were worshiping the Lord with all their heart, and the congregation could worship with them and rejoice because they can see the future of where that's going, right? We don't have to have things all accomplished in front of us. We have to have a hope for the future, and that's where the kids are, you know? So I don't know.
That yeah,
Sounds like
it's an
we have,
interest.
you know, we're at an hour and a half here. So
Yeah,
I'm
we
going to
are.
let you wrap up. But we got through the first sentence of a two-page email. So it sounds like we have to get together again.
Oh man, the thing about the last thing you said is I remember whenever someone would tell me, "Hey, Christian, worship was really great today." I never knew what they meant. I think I always took it as I, because maybe I would know if the band did really good and we had a good sound guy that Sunday. And okay, yeah, it was, going on all cylinders or something. And then to contrast that with the story that you just told about the kids and the hodgepodge, orchestral ensemble that would get assembled that week thereof be and before. I would just say this, that there are, like, again, I think there's a, we want transcendent music. We want beautifully true and magnificent, glorious things and cathedrals and like we see that as a reality. But I think that recognizing that those things exist, that at the same time that if I'm my own priest, because I'm a priesthood of the believer and I'm maybe the priest in my house, but I'm not everybody's priest, that there's a fractal reality to that. And that music or the worship of God is does ultimately come down to the individual and their attention and their attending to how they are responding and remembering and relating back to God. But that there are opportunities for deeper levels of that and deeper levels of finding sacred practice and sacred places to do those things with. And
Well,
the answer is
I
not
would just
clear.
add, I would just add that God is the one who puts the transcendence into the music, not our excellence, not our great compositions, not our great. God is the one who brings the transcendence. He's the one who filled the temple with his glory. So, yes, excellence is important. I'm not putting down excellence, but excellence by itself is meaningless if God doesn't bring the transcendence.
I love
God
that.
can bring the transcendence to a little kid playing his horn as best he can
Yeah.
in a way that would blow you away.
It does. And that gets lost in a room that can be more easily lost in a room of 1,000 people that don't know that kid than if there's 100 people in that room that truly love that kid. And I think that's that hard, fast thing that we're coming up against. And that I think is interesting in thinking about what does it mean to have a quote unquote healthy church and good worship in the future.
Well, let's get together again. This has been great.
Yeah.
Thank you,
This was
Christian.
awesome. Thank you, Karen. I really appreciate you making time to have me come back on.
I'm thankful you took the time. You've been super busy, so so this has been great. Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Right, you too, Karen.
Bye-bye.